Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Corner Store Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Koval. Thank you so much for tuning in and week out. You know, we've had a reconfiguration on Apple Music, and so this is just another reminder to make sure that you resubscribe to the Corner Store with my name, Kevin Koval. Please consider giving us a rating, those 5 stars, if you will. As you know, we bring creatives into the space every week, and today we have a very special guest, an author whose work I deeply admire both as a journalist and as a historian, someone whose book I've recently finished and am a big fan of. In the building, we have Kathy Iandoli.
Hello, hello.
Thank you so much for being here, and it's a real wrap. I just not too long ago finished your very, very dope book, God Save the Queens.
Thanks for checking it out. Yeah, it went to paperback 3 months ago now. That was pretty cool.
It is, what I love, I wrote a book called A People's History of Chicago. I'm like a faux historian, fake historian. And of course, love your centering of women in this narrative of history, which I think it's probably, misogyny and patriarchy that kind of decenters women. But you've done such a dynamic job of from the beginning to now of ensuring that women are rightfully in the center of this conversation. But the work that you did of framing and continually reframing is just very dope.
Thank you so much.
But let's talk about, this book, I imagine, it's a well-documented, well-researched history. What made you want to tell the story, and how long did it take you to tell it?
Well, first off, I originally wanted to write a book like this about 10 years before I actually got the book deal. It was a harder sell in 2008, 2009, because at that point, it was right before Nicki Minaj popped off. And I think that arguably in hip hop, mainstream women, female artists were not that big at that point. And I think that, a lot of times major publishers at least kind of look at things through a very singular lens, and it was a lot harder sell. So, over the course of those 10 years in between actually starting to write the book, I had made writing about women in hip hop my primary beat as a hip hop journalist. And by the time I brought the conversation back on the table, we had an abundance of women in the space, which was amazing. And it made it a lot easier to want to approach these publishers and kind of sell the story. But then when you turn around and you're looking at how much history you have to actually put together at that point, it was 40 years. So, prior to that, it was 3 decades. Then I had 4 decades to worry about.
Right. And so, yeah, but you mentioned, of course, this has been obviously something that you've been writing about for a long time. You have credits and credits and credits as a journalist, many, many bylines. How did you even begin to get started there? I mean, how did you even click into wanting to write about the culture and the genre and the art?
So I started, my first job as, I guess, in the music industry was in 96. I worked at a record store. And
where are we? Is this Jersey? I know you have Jersey.
Yeah, we're in suburban New Jersey at a Sam Goody.
Right. Get a disc or tape at Sam Goody.
Empire Records or but it was, I actually got that job because I saw Empire Records and I was like,
wow.
Yeah. It was so I worked there for a few years. And after that, I started handing out flyers for the Roots. And around the same time, I started to do really rough, lowbrow journalism, writing, just kind of I guess the equivalent of what were zines,
Yeah.
To punk. And I don't, hip hop had a few zines, but didn't have my name in them, but I did write for a couple of spots. And then, you know, I started to take it a little more seriously, and I kind of ran the gamut of industry jobs, right? I worked at a major label. I worked in artist management. I worked in radio, but all throughout I wrote, you know, I worked at Fat Beats, you know, and I kind of just kept myself entrenched in the music industry in all of its various forms. And I think that for me, writing always stuck. So, you know, I went to NYU and got my master's in music business and, you know, became a professor and all these other things, and just wanted to approach it from a very different angle, because at the point that I started writing, print journalism was kind of floundering, right? And I still managed to, you know, get my reps in and Vibe and Source and places like that. But, you know, I was turning more towards digital and just kept trying to put the conversation in places that it wasn't being had, right? So, you know, there was nothing more frustrating than mainstream publications having discussions on hip hop and not knowing really what they were talking about, right? So what I did was, as soon as, you know, I earned my stripes in the hip hop journalism, you know, arena.
Yeah, no, and a ton. I mean, you wrote for a lot of different spaces, right? I mean, Billboard, yeah. Pitchfork, Source, XXL, Vibe. I mean, you have credits and credits and credits as a freelance. I mean, were you ever on staff somewhere, or were you just freelancing all this?
I was an editor at allhiphop.com. I was an editor at BET.com, and I was an editor at hiphopdx.com. And very briefly, I had helped with the relaunch of undergroundhiphop.com. So, you know, I kind of, you know, made my moves in each of the, you know, main digital hip hop sites and stuff. So yeah, I was on staff for a couple places, but managed to still, like, I guess, you know, one thing that I always wanted to do was continue the conversation of hip hop, and sometimes the conversation has to, you know, transcend the hip hop, you know, groups, like the hip hop site or anything. So what was happening was, like, I would be like an editor at a hip hop site, but then I would write hip hop pieces for The Guardian or BBC, or Pitchfork, and just really just try to continue the conversation while I was still helping to cultivate hip hop in a hip hop journalism, you know, forum. So yeah, I was doing a lot at once. And then around 2015, my dear friend Prodigy, God rest his soul, came to me and said he wanted to do another book. So he and I did a book, and it released in 2016.
This is the cookbook that you guys wrote together.
Yeah,
is that
Commissary
right?
Kitchen.
Yeah.
And my infamous prison cookbook.
Yes.
So we wrote that book, and we had a couple of other plans for more books in the pipeline. And obviously God had other plans for P. So, you know, I reached the summer of 2017 after he passed, and I was, like, really just trying to figure out what was going to be next, you
Wait,
know, for me.
If I can, how did you become close with him, if I can ask?
You know, I think the thing with Prodigy, I was on his first interview when he got out of prison. And the one thing was, I was always a Mobb Deep fan and always a huge Prodigy fan, right? But there was a part of Prodigy that was so witty and so sarcastic and had such a dry sense of humor. And the day I met him before he went in, you know, like through hip hop or whatever, but we really connected at Dojo over by NYU. And for whatever reason, we just have the same dry sense of humor. Like, and we just like, you know, spoke this mutual language of sarcasm, and we were just talking it out about some things. You know, I had on other books, like, you know, Jay-Z's Decoded and stuff, and P was kind of like really fascinated by the idea, you know, he did My Infamous Life, but he was just really fascinated by kind of continuing in the literary world. I mean, he had a small company called Infamous Books, where he, you know, released a lot of things, and he was doing stuff with men in prison who were writing books, and he was filling their commissary. He was doing a lot of cool things.
And he could write, for real. He could write. I mean, obviously, he could rap for real, but he could write for real, mm-hmm. too. I mean, he could write books for real. Like My Infamous Life is an incredible memoir.
It is. And it's all from letters that he wrote to Laura Checkaway, like pages, just, you know, and... Yeah, he was but he read so much. Mm. You know, they always say that the half of writing is reading, right? And he read and read and read and read. So, of course, he could write, right? So, you know, I think he was just very much looking for kind of someone that he can just work on things with and put his thoughts together with and kind of just do that. And, you know, we vibed, and, you know, it was like just going back and forth. And, like, you know, sometimes I still look at our text conversations of just like the sarcastic things we would say back and forth. And we just had a lot of plans. He had a lot of plans. You know, he wanted to do so many different things. And it was me. I had my next 5 years mapped out in terms of my career with him. Mm. And after he passed, you know, you just have to really, like, figure out, like, what you're going to do next, right? I felt like Puffy at the end of Victory, you know? Like, what are we supposed to do now? Like,
right.
Literally.
Right.
Like, you just, you know, it was like everything just kind of fell apart. But I reintroduced the idea of a book on women in hip-hop, and it hit. And then, you know... Thankfully, that book came, and then Aaliyah came, and, you know, the whole thing just kept
going. Right, and you're, of course, mentioning your book, which is forthcoming, about Aaliyah. You know, when does that drop? And yeah, I mean, I'm so excited to read it, but what can we expect, too, from it?
It's called Baby Girl, better known as Aaliyah, and it's coming out August 17th through Atria Books. I'm in Schuster. Which is a different publisher from God Save the Queens. God Save the Queens came out through D Street, HarperCollins. You know, I felt that after 20 years, there needed to be a more comprehensive kind of biography on Aaliyah that didn't just end with her death. You know, so much of Aaliyah's legacy is what happened in the 20 years since she passed. You know, there's a reason why she still comes up in conversations. There's a reason why people still dress like her. There's a reason why people are still so excited for the day that her music can come on streaming platforms. So, you know, I wanted to just create a biography or just, you know, an all-encompassing story that honors her in a different way from how she had previously been spoken about in other projects and books and stuff, and just really talk about, you know, what she did while she was here and then how her impact has lasted after she left.
No, certainly. Yeah. Well, I'm very much looking forward to that. There are a few things in God Save the Queens that I want to talk about. And you mentioned 20 years. One of the things that struck me, and it almost like I had to pause, and I might've like low key or high key, like wept, that it's really been 20 years since we've really heard from Ms. Lauryn Hill. And you have such a beautiful section in your book about her and about her work, but you say something of, I mean, that might be even, I'm you know, misquoting, but you kind of, you frame it in that way, that it's been two decades since arguably, you know, the illest, one of the illest, at least top five to ever do it, we've really heard from in a significant way. That really struck me as a profound moment in your book.
Yeah, and I purposely dedicated two chapters to Ms. Lauryn Hill because, well, for one, she's one of my favorite artists of all time, you know, and I feel like there were two parts to her career, right? There was everything she contributed to the industry and then everything the industry took from her. So I wanted to make sure that I, A, made that delineation, but B, ended on a note where she doesn't really owe us anything.
Right.
Because, you know, I think for me as a writer, but also for me as a hip-hop fan, And I think for so many of us who have left that door open, I wanted to give us some form of closure. Now, she may come out with an album at some point, right? That may happen. But I wanted to run through the reasons and the facts as to why that may not be and why that's okay. You know, I really don't like the conversation that centers around the fact that people will argue that she is not a legend because she only had one solo project, where if she were killed, she could be considered a legend with one solo project, right? And the reality is she had two group projects, one solo project and one live album. So if that's not criteria enough, you know, I don't like the way that, you know, the rules lean in male artists' favor when it comes to how they can judge about like skill or GOAT status or, you know, legendary status. And it's just one of those things where, you know, just because she's still here and choosing not to give us more music does not mean that we can't judge her by the music that she did give us and talk about how incredible that was. Now, people may not have liked the way the Unplugged album was presented, but half of the rhymes that she was talking about still speak today.
Right.
Like, she was saying things. She had bars, right? And you may not like the fact that she was crying with an acoustic guitar, but, listen with your ears and not your eyes. And I think that, you know, so much of just what we did to Lauryn Hill,
yeah,
because everyone was so demanding. Everybody wanted more and more and more, and didn't give her enough time to kind of take it all in. And the one thing that I always talk about is she was like barely 23 years old when Miss Education Lauryn Hill came out. I remember what I was doing at 23.
Right.
And I would have sure as hell been overwhelmed.
A bunch of fuck shit, you know, just,
insane.
Well, I look forward to that biography, maybe, in your future from you.
Your lips to God's ears.
Listen, just put it out there. You know, one of the other things, and I don't want to make you talk about every single chapter in your book, but I really, it meant a lot. I love how you framed early on the Roxanne Wars, you know, because, you know, the way you position it, and this is true, of course, that it was one of the first moments on Wax where we saw this very public battle take place, right. That was created by essentially, a woman responding to a fiction. I love that moment that happens very early on in the culture, particularly the culture on Wax, and how you give credit to those pioneering women of that moment.
Well, it was really funny how, you know, the Roxanne Wars, like, it was like a schism, right? Of sorts, where people were jumping in. I mean, we had someone who claimed that she was the real Roxanne, you know? But, you know, Shantae took on the personality of Roxanne to give that person a voice in song, right? So, you know, UTFO is sitting here, you know, going after this random girl, this random Roxanne, making her have no voice on how, like, why she wasn't, you know, acknowledging their advances. And Shantae came in and was like, let me respond from her perspective, or let me explain to you why you're not getting that call back. And the first thing that they chose to do was to take the identity away again, right? No, this is the real Roxanne. And then what started to happen was a bunch of artists just jumped in and just started to use Roxanne as kind of like the target. You know, and Shantae talks about this, you know, in other interviews where she says that, like, she was target for the most songs in hip hop history, like, against a particular person.
Right.
Which is just insane.
Yeah.
And she was a teenager.
Right. Like a teenager. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No.
So.
Yeah. No, I love the stories that you share. And of course, her voice in there. You know, you do a really beautiful thing in the book too, where you, I wouldn't say qualify, but you know, you're forthright about an examination of your own whiteness. And I think one of the great things that hip hop does for so many of us is that it makes whiteness visible and something that we then have to wrestle with if we're part of the cultural space. And you do a great job in the book of saying that, not only profoundly in one particular moment where it's more explicit, but time and again where you're saying women, and then, you know, you particularly women of color have it, you know, harder than you, is, you know, what I'm paraphrasing, but I'm wondering how a white girl from suburban New Jersey, you know, not only finds her way to be, you know, a historian, a documentarian, someone who's writing about the culture, but of course, you know, and I know that your mom passed, and I'm sorry about that. Rest in peace. But I wonder what they thought about this, and what they, you know, thought, you know, early on. To obviously this is your career, but you know, from that time when you were, even before Sam Goody, to then, you know, publishing and living a life very much immersed in the culture.
So I had this kind of split life growing up. You know, my parents were divorced since I was a kid, like, you know, two, right? And my family, when they came from Italy, they all came to Paterson, New Jersey, which is an inner city. And my mom taught in the inner city. And my grandmother still lived in the inner city. So growing up, I went to school in Paterson, and I primarily stayed in Paterson while my mom worked. So most of my, like, childhood into teenage years was spent in Paterson, right? So, you know, I would come home to the suburbs of Hawthorne, New Jersey, and I'm wearing my Debbie Harry, my Blondie t-shirt, because she and I had the exact same history. You know, her family's from Paterson, and then they moved to Hawthorne, right? So I had that same thing. You know, Hawthorne's a tiny suburb of Paterson. And it was interesting because, you know, most hours in the day were spent in Paterson, and then I would come home and see my suburban friends, and it was like we were from two different planets. And I would, like, it was almost having to costume change, right? Where, you know, I knew who I actually was, but, you know, it's hard to go home and talk about all the walls you were writing on to your friends, you know. But
so wait, did you, what were you writing, by the way? What was your nom de plume?
I went from K-Love to Lady K. And then when I signed up for the Roots OK Player boards, ECA, but it was LIDIE, and you know, I did that one for a little while too.
Dope.
So and then for a little bit of time, I did Lady I, because my last name is Yandali, but I'll never forget, like, the way, for some reason, the way that I tagged Lady I, the D, like, I don't, for some reason, it just looked like I was writing lay one. And I remember just being like, I gotta change this. Like, I was always, like, switching it up because I, you know, you just kind of had to. Especially, you know, I just it wasn't like I had a far and wide, you know, canvas. So you tag five or six times, and then they're like, then they find you, and then you gotta switch it up again. Right. You know what I mean?
That's right.
So it was one of those things where I went through in a very, you know, organic progression through all of the elements of hip hop, you know, growing up in Paterson, essentially. And by the time I got to, you know, pick a career, let's say, right, and I knew I wanted to work in music, like, it was a no-brainer. I mean, I there was nothing, there was nowhere else I'd rather be, right? So I think that there is, and I always cringe when white people will say things like, well, you know, I'm not actually from the inner, you know, like, inner city. And, you know, I never want to be the some of my best friends are black person, right?
But, no, of course, yeah.
You know, but in terms of, like, the actual purity of hip hop, yes, some of my best friends are black, but that's not the point, right? the actual purity of hip hop was something that was a part of me since I was very young because of where most of my time was spent. So it wasn't something that was inauthentic where, you know, I was kind of like a voyeur, you know, I was very much entrenched in it. And to the point where I almost had to kind of like, you know, understand that, you know, I wasn't posturing. It wasn't like some Rachel Dolezal type thing, but there were things that I didn't understand as a little kid.
Of course.
Yeah. Right. Because yeah. When you're a kid in the 80s, right. So I'm talking like, you know, 89, I was like 10 years old. Right. And a big fan of A Different World. Right. But it didn't. And, you know, my grandmother, my family owned a cleaners in Patterson on Madison Avenue. It was called Victory Cleaners. And on all my days off, I would stay at the cleaners and I would walk up and down the streets in like downtown. Well, it's not the downtown Patterson, but it's an offshoot of like the downtown area, right? Still very much Patterson. But I would go and, you know, I'd walk to the bodega and I would get my little, you know, roll with butter every morning or whatever. And then they would have like, you know, like shops where there'd be magazines and all this stuff. So I'd buy a copy of Word Up. And then like one day I came back, like, you know, my mom would give me a couple of dollars to like buy whatever I wanted that day. And I came back and I bought a leather African pendant because, you know, you see like X-Clan. Wearing
yeah,
it,
or exactly.
Like,
you know, no, trust.
Like, I'm just like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I just like, you know, I came walking back, right, with a copy of Word Up and an African pendant. Right. And it didn't like connect with me. And my mother, like, you know, my mother, God rest her soul, but, you know, God bless her soul. My mother, like, never, my mother always taught me to see color. Like, anybody who ever says, I don't see whatever, like, you're not, that's not a realistic approach to race, right?
Yeah.
But my mother, like, actually had to sit me down and explain to me, like, this is Africa, okay? This is a continent that may be 75 miles from where we're from, right? But you are not African, so just understand, you know, like, understand that. And, you know, we, like, taught me all about Africa and taught me about the different parts. I knew more about the African continent than I did about pointing out states on an American map, right?
Yeah.
But
no, shout out to your mom. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
mom.
Yeah, for real.
But, you know, she was like, this, and it was a different time, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Where,
yeah,
you know,
we didn't have the same understanding about, you know, and I think hip hop was, you know, I mean, you know, you're 10 years in or 12 years in, whatever, and it's such a new phenomenon. I mean, I mean, at 13, I told my mom I wanted to be a Black Panther because, you know, that's what I heard on Wax, you know, and she
right.
was not as patient nor as smart as your mom and just, you know, beat the shit out of me. But you know what I mean? Like, it was. Like it, but yeah, it's like at that moment, like there wasn't the kind of, we didn't have the language or the racial discourse, you know, but, mm-hmm. but I do think, you know, I'm very grateful in that sense that because of those experiences, even to what you're saying, I mean, that hip hop made me very aware of race in a way that I think we are still reticent to have the conversation in this country about it in some ways. And it wasn't about color blindness. It was about recognizing our differences, celebrating them, making fun of them, roasting one another because of them.
Yes.
But recognizing that they are present.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, you have to kind of, you know, and I also had, one day I came home wearing a kufi. Like I didn't, or even like the leather,
oh, like the Kumo D joints? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, the one, like, I had an Africa on.
Oh, word, yes, nice.
Like, I literally came home, like, every day. This is one particular store. I will never forget it. It was right on Madison Avenue, and, you know, they had, like, all of the magazines, and just on one rack, it was, like, leather hats with Africa and pendants and everything. And every time, every day I got money, I would come home wearing a new item, and my mom would be like, all right, look,
right,
this is what this is. And I'm like, all right, cool, but I could still wear it, right? And like, she actually wasn't like, take that off. Like, you know, she was just like, if you're going to wear it and someone questions you, you have to, you can explain to them why you're wearing it. Yeah. Right. And what it means to you, because now you know where Africa is on a map. Right. Because, you know, I mean, I can't speak for a public school or private school in, you know, the 2020s, but in the 80s, they weren't like,
weren't teaching really us about teaching much of anything
about the rest of the world, especially, with black and brown people.
No, big facts. Well, you know, when I think of Patterson, I think of, you know, some of the great poets that are from there, you know, William Carlos Williams, Allen Ginsberg. And yes. I wonder as a writer, you know, what your practice is, and what it's like. How often do you come to it? How long does a book take you, you know, things of that nature too.
So I definitely think that, and maybe it's because I'm a double Pisces, right? But I definitely have, I'm undiagnosed ADD or creative ADD, something where my head is always going in, like, you know, multiple directions when it comes to writing, especially because I tend to be the person who will write everything. I'm not a one project girl, right? I never was since the moment I started, because I think, you know, I started in a very turbulent time in journalism, where working full-time at just a magazine wasn't wise, because the next day you could be laid off and be done with it. So I always had just a bunch of projects. And what I would do is, like, if I knew I had a project due, for some reason I just felt like I had to do all the other projects instead. You know, maybe it's just, like, the rebellious nature of my brain. But, and it's always writing, so it's not like I'm not writing. But what I would do is, I always felt like I had to have, like, a clean space. Like, I have to have nothing to do, and then I can write, you know? Never works. So really, especially in this pandemic, this has been a test on my discipline as a writer. Like, incredibly, like, difficult. So what it used to be, my old pre-pandemic process was I would wake up in the morning and I would, you know, go to the gym, and then I would walk in the park, right, as like kind of a park meditation. But then, funny enough, I would go to the mall and then walk the mall. Mm. The New Jersey Mall, like, super suburban. I don't know what it was where I needed both.
Right.
Then I would do a couple laps in a bookstore, and then I would go, and every day I would buy my groceries for the day, because, you know, working from home and just being isolated was just crazy to me. So by the time all that happened, I would get up super early, and then I would come home and write. Mm. But I had to have a day full of experiences. So I would literally, then I would write, let's say, from like noon to 6, and by 6 p.m. I'm in the city.
Nice.
Either going to an event, hanging out with friends, whatever. Obviously, all of those days are on a pregnant pause. So now it's become a little more zen. I don't know. Like, I'll wake up in the morning. I bought myself a little, not a Peloton. And I bought myself a little treadmill. So I run in the morning, and then I meditate, and then I get in front of my computer and I go. But I also have to have like a little like psych myself up session.
Yeah.
Because I don't have my car, right? Like, I'm not like driving around. So I have to have like my half hour boogie session. And I'll do that, and then I write.
Dope. Well, Kathy Yandoli, it's been a pleasure and honor to speak with you. Where can the internet stay in tune with all of what you're doing? Where's the best place to keep tabs?
All social media, KATH3000, KATH3000.
Dope. Well, thank you so much for being in the Corner Store. Really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Shout out our super producer, DJ Cashera. Big up boss man, Todd Manley. Thank you to our official Corner Store photog, Mercedes Zapata. Salutes to the Snack Door, Max. Also, please, y'all, follow our Instagram. It's corner_pod on IG, on Twitter. Tell us who you want to see in the corner store, and also please consider dropping a couple of dollars into our Patreon account. It's patreon.com/cornerstore_pod.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.